I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. You know, the world is looking at this day after Christmas and saying, oh, thank goodness, the Christmas season which began with Halloween is now over. And, you know, it's really a terrible thing that we know that we didn't celebrate the Christmas season at all. Advent began 4 Sundays ago, and we celebrated looking forward to the coming of the Christ child, and it's only now that the Christmas season finally begins. And for the next, 3 weeks, we will be celebrating Christmas and the arrival of the Christ child. You know, on this first day after the celebration of the birth of Jesus, it may seem inappropriate to take our eyes off that miraculous event and look back to the future as we were reading the Revelation passages today. But with the end of the millennium coming up at the end of this week, it's difficult not to pay attention to this approaching awesome event, especially with all the press that has been given to the Y2K computer disaster. And on the way in today, I had seen this magazine on the racks a while back, but I never had gotten it, and I talked Betty into letting me stop and pick it up. Because, you know, we've all been wondering what is going to happen on January 1st. But, I mean, it's absolutely certain. All banks will fail. Food supplies will be depleted. The stock market will crash. Electricity will be cut off. Vehicles using computer chips will stop dead. Telephones will cease to function, and devastating worldwide depression will follow. Oh, my. And we have wondered all the time. No wondering about it. It's in print now. Yeah. There are a few other worthwhile articles in there, especially I like the one, and I'm looking forward to reading it, about the radio signals that NASA has picked up coming from the center of the Earth. I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, there are maybe some unknowns. But, you know, actually, the programming defect that's called Y2K came to my attention a long time ago. You know, in 1973, I began my first job in data processing right here in the Department of Transportation as a programmer analyst. And one of the programs that I wrote at that time was called Edit Date, which was to provide a common routine for validating dates that were entered into the various systems that we were developing at that time. And as a result, I was very much aware of the fact that most dates stored in our files failed to record the value of the century. It was absolutely unnecessary, of course, because it was the 20th century. But anyway, to save precious storage space, we knew that this could be a problem at the beginning of the next century, but the expected life of a computer program at that time, even the custom programs that we were developing, was much less than 27 years. And besides, we all expected to be retired by the year 2000. Well, as it turned out, I was wrong on both counts. I've been told that my edit date and a related date calc routine are still being used at DOT. As a matter of fact, they're still being used at the Department of Corrections, where I'm working now. And there are other centers around the United States that are using the same routine, where a local software house that was made up of former DOT programmers, they worked on installing systems around the country, and that same program is there. And my 30-year retirement won't come until August of 2000. Oh, my. So I will be joining many other data processing people who will be gathering at their respective computing centers this coming Friday and Saturday to find out what the effects of entering the 21st century will be on our systems. Of course, there have been major efforts expended over the past several years to assure that our own programs will have no problems, but there's always just a little bit of uncertainty about events of the future. Well, this is not the first time that there has been a simultaneous end to a year, a decade, a century, and a millennium. It's happened only one other time since the birth of Jesus 2,000 years ago, and that was in the year 1,000. We might wonder how the world viewed the ending of that first millennium. Fortunately, this week I heard McGray speaking of just having finished a book dealing with just that topic, and he allowed me to borrow it. The book is The Year 1000, What Life Was Like at the Turn of the First Millennium, An Englishman's World. Well, kind of a restricted view, but it was interesting anyway to find out what it was like in that millennial year. Of course, there were differences then. There was no Y1K computer glitch to be concerned about. In fact, a common English language was just beginning to evolve among the Anglo-Saxons, Frankish, and Danish settlers of the British Isles, and the idea of having a literate public had only been conceived within the past century by the king known as Alfred the Great. However, there were some concerns. Clerics of the time, that's preachers and such, were very familiar with the revelation of John that was written in the first century. And it had been a part of the canonical books of the Bible for nearly 700 years. In particular, they knew of the millennium passages that I read at the beginning that promised the troubled and persecuted Christians of John's time a 1,000-year period of peace during which Satan was to be bound and thrown into the abyss, and the world would be ruled by Christ and representative saints or resurrected martyrs. Now, the Christian's life at the end of the first millennium was no bed of roses, but the adoption of Christianity as the official religion of the Holy Roman Empire by Emperor Constantine in the 4th century and the relatively tranquil existence of the church in the succeeding centuries had led one influential leader or church father called St. Augustine to propose that the 1,000-year period of Christ's reign had begun with the birth of the church, as recorded in Acts. Now, the events in Acts took place early in the first century A.D., so you can imagine that those who were living at the end of the first millennium must have been paying some attention to what John had to say about the events following that time of peace. In particular, the loosing of Satan for a brief time with the potential disasters that might accompany such an event caught their attention, and the need to be prepared for the promised judgment which would follow the final defeat of Satan was a major concern. For an event of such cosmic importance, you might expect them to look to the cosmos for signs of its approach. And you can imagine their excitement when in 989 there appeared a terrifying comet in the night sky during the month of September. And it remained visible for the next 3 months. It was recorded that the comet would appear at nightfall and shone so brightly that its light seemed to fill the greater part of the sky. And then it would blink out with the first cock's crow in the morning, only to reappear the next evening. Well, the comet that appeared then is now known as Halley's Comet, which returns cyclically every 76 years. But soon after that appearance of the comet, the Church of St. Michael, the one we now know as Mont Saint-Michel on the island of Brittany off the coast of Britain, was burnt down. And in 993, just 4 years later, it was recorded that almost all the cities of Italy and Gaul were devastated by violent conflagrations or fires, and Rome itself was largely razed by fire. The writer continued to note that, as one, the people gave out a terrible scream and turned to rush to confess to the Prince of Apostles. Certainly, these events must be marking the end of the peaceful millennium. But the millennial year passed without any absolute confirmation that the apocalyptic vision had been fulfilled, which caused them to begin to anticipate the year 1033 as the pivotal year, because that would mark the millennium of Christ's passion and the actual establishment of the church, so that ought to be the end of the millennium. It was recorded that heresy broke out around 1030 A.D., and there were horrendous famines which forced men into cannibalism. More beloved and distinguished church figures passed away, and pilgrims set off for Jerusalem in vast and unprecedented numbers. And according to one writer, it was believed that the order of the seasons and the elements had fallen into perpetual chaos, and with it had come the end of mankind. It could portend nothing other than the advent of the accursed Antichrist, who was expected to appear at the end of the world. Well, again, the anticipated year passed without the awaited appearance of the end times, and the world settled once more into only casual interest in the visions of John, until the nearing of the end of the second millennium. Once more, interest in the visions recorded in Revelation have drawn the attention of many, including those of us who were led by Jessica and Stephanie in a brief review of the book in recent weeks. And it was a fun time, wasn't it, Leonard? Yeah, it was. And Greg was there and several others. What really drives this renewed interest in the apocalypse? You know, sometimes I feel that the preoccupation with the end times is the result of a planning method that has been in use for many years by both the faithful and the unfaithful, but has only recently been employed in business. Today it's called JIT, JIT marketing, just-in-time marketing. You see, the idea is that the products and components that are going to be acquired just in time to fill shipments for orders received, so you don't have to worry about inventory. Just-in-time marketing. You know, a comment of my dad several years ago reminded me that we use similar planning for our retirements, wanting to save up just enough to carry us through our days in this world, not coming up short to force some years of worrisome rationing or having too much unenjoyed wealth left over for an unappreciated posterity. For the world, the order of business has long been just-in-time sinning, or just-in-time repentance. The idea being that there was no sense in turning aside from the pleasures of sinning until it was really necessary, with the arrival of the end times, either personal or general, being the target date for necessary action. However, with the support of an ancient Jewish belief concerning a series of 1,000-year periods, one for each day of creation, in a tabulation of years that is now approaching 6,000, it might appear that the millennium of peaceful rule for the day of rest, that seventh day, might truly be due. If so, then the preliminary battle of Armageddon, as well as other significant disasters and events that are to precede it, should also be coming into view. During this century, every disaster has been examined to fit into John's record of events, and the rise of every leader or world power, every conflict between the forces of good and evil, have been viewed as signs of the end times, and we all know that. I know that during the last half century, my father was very much anticipating the year 2000 as the time when Jesus would come again to free this world from Satan's power. It has only been in very recent years that he's relented in his anticipation of the day we will be observing this coming Saturday. And you know, I'm not sure whether the loss of that anticipation is really a good thing, because I think a lot of people find comfort in the thought that it might be coming, just as those persecuted Christians in the days of John looked forward to the same events. But while the newspapers continue to be filled with the record of continuing disasters, just as Patty pointed out to us in these days, for both individuals and nations, the greatest concern for our world seems to have settled on the consequences of our own folly, the Y2K bug. So how should we look forward to this day? Of course, we could simply listen to those who point out, quite correctly, that the next millennium really doesn't begin until the year 2000. Or we could, yeah, there was an article in here that was sort of interesting. If we want to continue to worry, there was, the black hole will swallow Earth on August 11th, the year 2000. And the Bible warns us of it. Okay? If you want to continue worrying, there are ample opportunities. Or perhaps we could simply begin or continue to live our lives in grateful recognition of what Jesus' birth, death, and resurrection so long ago means for us today and for all who have lived or who will live. In the words of Jesus, recorded in John's Gospel, God so loved the world that He gave His one and only Son, that whosoever believes in Him shall not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send His Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through Him. Light has come into the world, but men loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be seen plainly that what he has been done through God. So how are we to live? In the light. And just what does that mean? Well, Jesus made it as clear and as simple as it can possibly be made when he said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. And for those who might have asked, who is my neighbor? Or who might qualify their love for both neighbor and self, Jesus told them that they should love others as I have loved you. While we may continue to anticipate the fulfillment of the promises and the coming of the New Jerusalem, for today we are simply to enjoy the comfort of knowing that God remains present with us and to share that joy with both the faithful followers and those who are still in the darkness.